I'm Terry Cooper, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you our three speakers. This past session of the General Assembly may not have been nearly as acrimonious as the one 2 years ago when Medicaid expansion was fiercely debated, but it wasn't a picnic either. Governor McAuliffe vetoed more bills than any governor in almost 20 years. And then, just days after the session ended, bypassed the legislature and issued an executive order purporting to restore various rights to some 206,000 convicted felons. That action will be challenged in at least one lawsuit and possibly two, one concerning the restoration of voting rights and the other concerning the impact on criminal prosecutions of allowing convicted felons to serve on juries in criminal cases. Here to review for us what happened in and around that session are three of our local legislators. After they speak, there'll be an opportunity to submit written questions. Let me say a word about our speakers. As you may know, I'm a partisan conservative Republican, but whatever your politics, you have to admit that we are truly fortunate to have the legislators that we do. They're all leaders, and they're all a great pleasure to work with. The gerrymanderers were very kind to us. Cree Deeds, on my immediate left, has been his party's nominee for Attorney General and for Governor. He is leading the effort to improve our identification and help for the mentally ill. Steve Landis, in the center, chairs the House Education Committee and is a senior member of its Appropriations Committee, the committee that writes the budget. David Toscano, on my far left, was chosen by his colleagues in the House Democratic Congress to be their leader. And let me pay my respects to two of our legislators who couldn't be here today. Senator Bryce Reeves is running for Lieutenant Governor, and Delegate Rob Bell is running for Attorney General. As I say, we are very fortunate. Please welcome Cree Deeds, Steve Landis, and David Toscano.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be back. Hopefully, you're going to learn something today. We're going to learn a lot from you guys, and hopefully have a little bit of fun doing it, too. So I'm going to talk a little bit because I got a PowerPoint, and they defer to me because I have a PowerPoint. And then we're going to move to whoever's going to speak next. Then we'll take your questions. And, you know, I'm an attorney, so I have to make a living, and if I walk out at 2:45, it's not because of anything you said. It might be because of one of these, what they said, but it wasn't because of what you said.
We're probably just going to annotate and interrupt what Dave said.
Yeah, okay. Right, and that's right. We're going to have a full discussion of this thing, if I can get it going. Okay, let's see if it comes up. Hey, okay. The good, the bad, and the funny. So let's start. Okay, you're going to do this, Blair. Hit it. Okay, state of play in Richmond, divided government. We've got a Governor Terry McAuliffe, Lieutenant Governor Northam, and Attorney General Herring, all Democrats. But in the Virginia General Assembly, it's a little bit different. In the Senate, we've got 21 Democrats and 21 Republicans, 18 Democrats. One Democrat recently died. And so there'll be a special election for that seat. And, of course, in the House of Delegates, it's 66 and 34. Okay, let's go. Oh, but it's working. Okay. So, some good things that we did this year. You always start with this. This is kind of a fun time. We did embrace a new state snake, and in the process we found out that we had left out the state flower and the state bird. You know, all you knew was dogwood and cardinal, but it was never in the code. And so now we fixed it. So you can all rest easily about this.
That's, we also did a state rock out.
Wait a minute. Here it is. This is the state rock we passed. This is Senator Deeds' bill. He's very proud of it. And that's what it looks like.
What's cool about that rock
is it was first identified in Nelson County. It was mined economically viable for a good part of the 20th century. It's still mined for its mineral content in Canada and China. And when it's mined there, they call it Nelsonite.
That's oh, there you go. Somebody actually knows what their bill says. That's very good. Okay, so now this was an interesting resolution. Steve and I voted for this on the House Rules Committee. We're both on rules. It's not good enough to have just a day devoted to Virginia barbecue. We have to have a whole season. So we passed a bill saying that the May through October is Virginia barbecue season. So you
and David said that's actually the first season we've ever adopted.
So if any of you guys want a season name for something, come to us. We'll try to put it through and pass it. Okay, how cute is this? Anybody know what this is? I think it's a boar, but they also call it a feral hog. Feral hog, very controversial beast in certain parts of the state. And so this year, it's not that cute because there are too many of them. And somehow, you've got to weed them out. So we passed a bill this year that allows state and federal agencies to hunt and kill feral hogs from aircraft. And we have a gentleman in the General Assembly who brought that bill who actually flies a helicopter. So that's why I got the helicopter up there for him. So we did pass that bill. We passed a bill saying you could now hunt wild birds and wild animals except deer, bear, elk, and turkey with a slingshot. This is a very sophisticated slingshot.
And just for the record, I voted against that bill.
So now if you really want to get it interesting here, as of July 1, will all these bills go through? We can hunt from the air feral hogs with slingshots. So, you know, be careful not to go down where they have a lot of feral hogs and you might get shot. Okay, some good stuff from this cycle. We put almost $1 billion more investment in K-12 in our budget. It's the biggest investment in quite a long time. A lot of us are very enthused about that, including 2% raise for teachers. A lot of money, more money going to higher education. And for those of you around here, UVA, wahoo, wah, $300 million new dollars in higher education. And it's a lot of it's designed to provide incentives to create more economic activity. PVCC and community college systems, over $12.5 million more for community college system for workforce credentialing. And it's important, workforce credentialing, we want to make sure not only that you get a credential, but you get a job. Sometimes you can get a lot of nice credentials, but they don't lead anywhere. And that's part of what we've been trying to do in the General Assembly, is to create that link. Also, a lot of new investments for veteran services. 2016 stalling economy, stupid. Job creation nationally, we're doing pretty well. But inequality still exists. Now, this is a really interesting slide. You haven't seen this slide. For those of you who don't know what a Gini coefficient is, a Gini coefficient is something the economists use to measure inequality. The higher the number, the greater the inequality. So you see New York, which has a lot of rich people, a lot of poor people, a lot of inequality. And you see where Charlottesville exists, and then you see other places like Loudoun County. We know that even though there are more jobs that have been created, a lot of those jobs are not paying a whole bunch. And so you get more inequality. And that's part of what Bernie Sanders has been hooked into over the cycle. This shows you Virginia and the United States GDP. Virginia used to come out of recessions a lot faster and a lot stronger than most parts of the country. This time, not so fast. and not so strongly. You can see the difference in the U.S. and Virginia GDP. That's why Governor McAuliffe every day is out there pushing to create more jobs.
And if I can, in large part, that's because since the end of World War II, our economy has been government spending. Our economy, the growth in the Commonwealth is built in Hampton Roads and Northern Virginia, and that's built on federal spending. When they cut that, it cuts our bottom line. It makes us have to work harder to create private growth or help create private growth.
See, this is great. We've worked so long together. He even anticipates the slides, even though he hasn't seen the slides.
Okay.
This shows what's been happening to the federal awards in Virginia over the last several years and billions of dollars. That's real money coming to Virginia and real jobs that are not in Virginia as a result. Here are DOD contracts. This is another indication. See, with sequestration and the cutbacks in the federal budget, you're seeing real impacts on Virginia. So it's still the economy, and we tried to pass things that would encourage more economic activity. Expansion of the R&D tax credits to reward companies who are doing a lot of research that would create more jobs. $50 million for Dulles Airport to make sure that they're on a good financial footing. Additional funding for the Commonwealth Opportunity Fund, and that shows what the governor's has done over the last since he's been in office. 154,000 jobs, $11 billion in capital investment committed, 649 new projects. Major facility job credit. All of these are designed to increase economic activity. A lot of investment in the ports. You all don't think much about the ports here, but they are a real big, important part of the Virginia economy. And Go Virginia, which is another initiative, a business initiative designed to create economic activity. What failed? Well, some folks tried to extend the coal tax credit. It was vetoed by the governor, and so that was not extended. There was no solar tax credit passed. The angel tax credit was debated and didn't find success. No increase in the minimum wage. Okay, still the economy. Bioscience is getting bigger in Virginia. We try to encourage more bioscience in Virginia. Sometimes it's not the economy. So there are some things that got passed that really have very little to do with the economy, and things that failed that had little to do with the economy. You can't smoke in a vehicle if you have a kid with you under age 8. So pay attention to that. None of you in this room smoke, do you? No. But if your friends do, tell them that. We can now produce industrial hemp. Whoopee. That's the Mitch Vanieri's bill from way back when. And we can talk about more of these as we go forward. Big gun compromise in exchange for taking guns away from people who are subject to protective orders and getting some voluntary background checks at gun shows. The reciprocity prohibition that the Attorney General Herring imposed was taken away. We can talk about that in more detail. Failures. Well, this is all, you know, this is my view about failures. We won't all agree. There are always attacks on the federal government, particularly the Clean Energy Plan. The legislature passed the rejection of the Clean Power Plan by Virginia, at least, would not allow us to embrace it without the legislature passing it. The governor vetoed it. It was sustained, so nothing happened with that. Medicaid expansion is still out there. I think you saw that slide last year. Jane Roush, that was a failure. You know, Justice Roush was fired from the Supreme Court. That's my humble opinion. It was a failure. Post-session events, restoration of voting rights, executive order April of 2016. Article 5, Section 12 gives the governor power to restore rights, and we can talk about whether that's a good idea or bad. Only 4 states as stringent as Virginia before the governor's action. No restoration of firearms rights. Your conviction remains on your record. You still have to pay your fines and costs. If you want to register and you're a former felon and you don't know how to do it, this is how you do it. And that's it for my PowerPoint. Thank you. We'll take questions, and Steve and Cree will have their time now. Thank you.
Okay. I,
I would just make three points about the session, because I think David did a good job of laying out what a lot of the big things were. You know, Richmond, the time I've been there, has become more partisan. But what we, the thing with education, the success we have with education, should, cannot be can't be overlooked. For years, we fought about education funding with one side for, one side against. We fought about the SOLs with one side for, one side against. This time, the governor put a lot of money in his budget for education. The Republican-controlled legislature put more money up the governor. We said, we agree with you, governor, but we want to do better than that. The SOLs, when that standards of learning tests, when they were imposed or first became law in about 1994, there were lots of people in the legislature like me that stood up and said, hold on a second, these things are going to cost local governments money. They're going to force teaching to tests, and they are going to de-emphasize vocational education. All of those things have come true. We've reformed the SOLs over the last three or four sessions in pretty significant ways. We've reduced the number of tests kids have to take, and we've also made it easier to retake tests when you come close to passing. We've done that with a bipartisan majority. So the legislators should get patted on the back for that. This gun deal, there's something to like, something to dislike, I guess, for everybody. What the Attorney General said last fall is that the reciprocity agreements Virginia had with 35 states weren't legal. They weren't legal because they didn't hold up to what Virginia law said they were supposed to hold up to. Well, he was right about that. But the bottom line is, most people who bother to go to the courthouse and do what it takes to get a concealed carry permit aren't going to be out there violating the law. There's really not a lot of anecdotal evidence about that anywhere in the country. So part of this agreement was a restoration of those agreements in 35 states, and the agreement went further and said, and if there are other 15 states want to enter into reciprocity agreements with Virginia, we'll do it. But the agreement said that those people that have permanent protective orders issued against them can't possess firearms while their protective orders in place. Now, that is probably the most significant domestic violence law enacted in the country. You know, that was one of the toughest laws in the country. So there was something to like, something to dislike on both sides of this deal. And that's something we were able to work together on, Democrats and Republicans. The governor led the way on that, frankly. This thing with Justice Roush is something that we ought to all be concerned about. For the first time in over 100 years, a sitting governor's appointment to the Supreme Court was not confirmed. Now, that's significant because Justice Roush, who's been on the bench for a number of years in Fairfax County, a trial judge, was a judge that handled all the tough cases. She handled one of the sniper cases, D.C. sniper cases. She was a hardworking, effective trial judge. And more than that, she was nominated to the governor by the chairman, the Republican chair of the House Courts of Justice Committee. She had support on both sides of the aisle, and she was replaced with a guy who graduated from law school in 1997, spent 2 years as a clerk, 12 years in the Attorney General's office, and then was put on the Court of Appeals. He's never spent one day practicing law in the private practice where you got to go out and scratch for a living. He doesn't know what it's like to represent real people. And nothing against him. I hope that he'll be a fine judge. He's smart enough. Hope he'll do a great job on the Supreme Court. But there's just no excuse for what happened. And in my view, it undermines the independence of the judiciary. Now, I know, Steve, we're going to disagree about some of this. We were talking about the lifetime appointment thing back before. In 1787, I guess, when Madison was putting the Constitution together, and Jefferson was a minister in France, Madison sent him drafts of what he had written in the Constitution, and Jefferson wrote back, well, I like this and I don't like that. And Madison didn't really much care what Jefferson thought. But one thing Jefferson said was, I really like the lifetime appointments in the federal judiciary. I like the independence it creates, the separation, complete separation of powers, you know, among the branches at the federal level. You don't have that in Virginia. I think it's bad. It's bad precedent to take this good judge off the bench, but it's even worse precedent because it undermines the independence of a judiciary that knows now that it better do the right stuff or they're not going to get reappointed.
Well, first of all, let me add my thanks to what David and Kriya said about having us here. I'm glad I could be here this year. I don't always make it every year, but try to get here as often as possible. As was mentioned, if you want a copy of the session highlights, they're in the back. That goes into much more detail about all these bills that David and Kriya have been talking about. What I thought I'd do is just real quickly hit on some things from my perspective that were important. Maybe talk about a few things that I might disagree with my colleagues a little bit on, and then I know we all want to take your questions. One of the things that I spend a lot of time on, and Terry mentioned, I am on the Appropriations Committee. I'm actually the vice chairman and I serve as a budget conferee, so I spend a lot of time on the state budget, the money that you send to Richmond for us to pay for the state services and the money that goes to the local governments related to our state spending. We adopted a budget this year that's $105 billion. That's the first time that we've gone over $100 billion for a biennial budget. And that's 2 years, but that's significant. Now, that was actually $4 billion less than what the governor proposed. And some of that was just adjustments. There's always, between the time the governor introduces the budget and when we get it, there are always adjustments, technical things that need to be changed. Sometimes there's more spending that needs to occur. Sometimes there's less. And then some of those things were just a few of the initiatives that the governor wanted that we just decided and agreed that we didn't see as high a priority. We spent, as David mentioned, almost $900 million for K-12, and that's significant in that I think most localities would tell you, their local schools have said for a number of years that they've had a tough time meeting their obligations with increased cost. At the same time, we were basically spending at the same levels that we were in 2008, 2009. Now, we've built back up to hopefully at least get more on par to where K-12 spending should be. We also set aside $605 million for the Rainy Day Fund, which is our revenue stabilization fund. That's the state savings account. If we ever have a downturn in the economy again, that's our cushion. Just as most families and individuals have a savings account or a rainy day fund, that's our state rainy day fund. We also, as David mentioned, invested $130 million for higher education and almost $82 million for natural resources. And those are significant in increases and, more importantly, investments for your tax dollars. As part of that, we actually did, as Kriya mentioned, a number of things related to education, significant things, not only from a funding standpoint, but some initiatives that we had. Unfortunately, one of those was House Bill 6, which was the virtual education school, and that was vetoed by the governor. And then we also had one bill that did pass, House Bill 895, dealing with high school graduation requirements. That's significant in that we are looking at, for the first time in Virginia, and Kriya mentioned we're getting away from the number of standardized tests with the SOLs and moving towards trying to right-size those and trying to make sure we're understanding and the students are understanding the knowledge that they need to have, and then we're testing for that. But the new model for high school we're looking at, and this bill will move forward in that direction, and that is the last 2 years of high school, we're looking to moving away from the traditional high school where you go to class every day, where you take SOL tests, where you're doing standardized tests, to allowing students a different opportunity. And if you're in higher education or that track and you're going to go to college, that'll allow you to take more AP classes. So that maybe by the time you get to your first year of college, you've already gotten your first year of college out of the way with the requirements through AP classes. We also, for higher ed students, track students, if they want to do a mentorship or an internship and really start learning about what they may want to do as a profession, they could be exposed to and have an opportunity for that. And for kids that are going to the career and technical schools and that want to work after they graduate from high school, what we're trying to do is see if they could be in an apprenticeship program and maybe going to the community college to do with the credentialing that we provide additional funding for, about $12 million for our community colleges. So that would be a real change in the direction and how we're doing high school for kids that are both going to higher ed and then also into a career. Now, a couple bills that I was lucky enough to introduce, and the governor signed. One was revisions to the Agriculture Forestry Industries Development Fund, House Bill 514. Albemarle County has actually seen some benefit from that, and it's a fund that we've actually appropriated some additional dollars, about $3 million each year of the biennium, and that's for small agriculture-related job expansions or bringing jobs into a community to help promote agriculture-related businesses. What we did with this bill is expand that to include fishermen and shell fishermen in the eastern part of the state so that they can access and those businesses can access those funds as well. Another thing we did was House Bill 515, which will require our institutions of higher learning for the first time to report annually as part of their six-year planning process what they're doing to help the local or regional economy. One of the things that we know, and the governor's talked about, the General Assembly's talked a lot about, and that is higher education institutions play an important role in local economies and the state's economy, whether it's research, and David mentioned the funds and the effort we're making towards more additional dollars for research, and that's important. But we've never had the General Assembly or the governor actually receive on an ongoing basis what the institutions of higher learning are actually doing to help local economies and regional economies. And that'll be a reporting that we get each year. And then the last one, last bill I want to talk about is House Bill 858 that the governor signed, which will create the Virginia International Trade Corporation. And what this will do is put in place a process where by September of this year, the General Assembly will get a report, and then we'll all have a chance to look at it from the Secretary of Commerce and Trade to set up this new entity or agency within state government to promote Virginia businesses internationally and to recruit business activity and potential export opportunities from other countries for Virginia. We're one of the few states that actually would have this set up and go in this direction. The Virginia Economic Development Partnership actually has a unit that does this now. It's envisioned that that unit would become the starting point, if you will, for this new corporation within state government. Again, we're going to get the report from the secretary. We hope that that'll be something the General Assembly will then agree to, and then the governor can fund in the second year of the biennium to set this agency up. Then the second year, once this is in place, the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services will be then bringing a report back through the Secretary of Agriculture and Forestry to move their international trade offices into this new entity as well. So every international trade facility office would be all coordinated and housed in this one new agency. And the last thing I'll say is we in the General Assembly have been trying to be more proactive in the interim rather than be reactive to either an administration, whether it's a governor's initiative or some other group coming and providing a issue for the General Assembly to consider. And actually, the Education Committee that I chair and then the Senate Education and Health Committee will be forming a new joint committee to look at over the next 2 years revising our standards of quality that haven't been looked at since 2004. And that sets kind of the standard, if you will, what every school system, every school should have and shouldn't have. And we're going to tie that to technology. One of the things our SOQs have not been looked at in conjunction with, and that is the new technology. For instance, Albemarle County is moving forward with a technology plan to have tablets for most school students in Albemarle. And we need to make sure that technology and desktop computers and all the other computer and technology and digital information that students have access to, that we tie that to the SOQs and make sure that the system we have in place for our standards of quality take that into consideration. So we're going to be looking at that over the next 2 years. And with that, the only thing I would disagree with my colleagues on, the restoration of rights issue that the governor took the initiative. The way I read the Constitution, he's supposed to consider those individually at one time, not as a group. So that's what the court case will determine, whether he was within his authority to do that. And then there's some question about, and I'm glad David had a part in the slide, but there's been some question about whether individuals are still being required to basically meet their obligations for court fees and also restitution contribution to victims, because I think that's very important. All of us want individuals, especially nonviolent offenders, from my standpoint, to be able to have their opportunity to have their rights restored. And actually, both this administration and the prior administration have done a great job in doing that. But doing it carte blanche for over 200,000 people without some really mechanism to make sure that they've filled their obligation, I think is problematic. And then the other thing with Justice Rauch, one thing I would say, she was a very qualified lady, and it was unfortunate from the standpoint of the situation that we found ourselves in. But it is the General Assembly's responsibility to make those appointments on a permanent basis. The governor recommends pro temporary appointments. The General Assembly decides who those people will be. And I think that is one of our responsibilities. And the fact is that many of us were not really included in that process of Justice Rauch being selected, even though she was a qualified individual. I think the gentleman that was appointed is just as qualified, and more importantly, has appellate court experience, which is something that I look for someone going on to the Supreme Court when possible. But I do think going forward that both this administration and the General Assembly need to communicate on a more ongoing basis when we're going to have these kinds of appointments and when someone resigns or passes away before their term and before the General Assembly's in session, because we've got to work together. No matter who's in office, who's governor, or who's in the General Assembly, that process has got to be more seamless. And that is something that we failed in this case. I think both the administration and both the General Assembly. So we can do better. And I look forward to your all's questions.
One question dear to my heart, what's the status of the redistricting reform legislation in Virginia?
You know, I've introduced that legislation since about 2002 or 2003, nearly every year. With respect to the specific constitutional amendment that I introduced again this past year, it's carried over till next year, which is generally a constitutional amendment year. You know, and I've said this before, and I've said it to you, and I've said it to a lot of people. I've grown weary of thinking the General Assembly is going to change that process. Power once achieved is very difficult to give up. I think the way to change the process is through the courts. I mean, I think that ultimately, whether you're in federal court or state court, that's where the process will have to be determined. That, you know, the Iowa, which kind of set the benchmark for redistricting reform in the early 70s, did so only in response to a lawsuit. So I think that's what it's going to take.
Well, as Terry knows, I'm kind of new to the redistricting reform column, but did introduce legislation this year to deal with the criteria that we use. The Constitution is pretty clear that the district should be both for congressional and then also legislative districts should be compact and contiguous. I think there's a way to do that through state statute, and that's what I introduced was a bill that I think Senator Howell and Senator Vogel on the Senate side had, and I know Senator Deeds has supported and tried to work with my colleagues both in the Republican and Democrat side. We weren't successful in committee, but I plan to try again next year. I think that's a way to start moving the ball in the right direction and having us really deal with the criteria before the next redistricting process. That would be a great reform. I'm not a big fan of independent commissions that give that authority to an unelected body. And to be honest with you, the way Iowa and some other places are set up, you assume that you're going to have someone who doesn't have a bias. Well, everybody has biases, and I hate to say it, but in redistricting, everybody's going to have a bias. They either like this area, they don't like that area. They want they're either their same representative or a new representative. So even if it's not partisan, there's going to be some biases in the system. But I do think the criteria is a way to go. And I think Cree's right. One of the things we talked about at lunch, I had a chance to meet with some folks from senior statesmen at lunch, is that I think the courts will determine, especially the federal courts, whether states need to look at their process, need to change the process. And obviously with the 3rd District, there's a perfect example there as well. And I will say, with this last redistricting process, it was bipartisan. The Democratic Party controlled the state Senate at the time, and the Republican Party controlled the House of Delegates. And so we're all, I guess, to take responsibility for the good and the bad of how the districts look at this point.
And that is exactly the rub. That is exactly the problem. And that is why you can't have the politicians in the middle of it. You know, with all the emphasis on the federal elections this fall, people forget how important states are. States really matter. And you really see it loudly and clearly with redistricting. And it's not just affecting state legislatures. It affects how Congress, who's elected to Congress, and what the composition of the Congress looks like. And so there, you limit the bias if you have a nonpartisan independent commission, because you don't have all these people making deals, which happened last time. People on my side of the aisle made deals to keep their seats. People on their side of the aisle made deals to keep their seats. And I think maybe the last redistricting, you and I probably were two of a very small number who voted against it. I mean, I did. I voted against the redistricting.
Well, here's the thing, in my view, and I disagree with my good friend Steve Landis. We've been friends for a long, long time, and we will still be friends, but we disagree violently on this issue. Guys like he and I have a built-in bias when we're drawing districts, because we like what we do. We want to be reelected. You know, what part of my constitutional amendment sets up a 13-member independent commission to draw the lines? I adopt the Iowa criteria in my approach to it, but the 13 members includes 6 Democrats, 6 Republicans, and they elect the 13th member who's going to be the chair, and that person cannot be affiliated with either party. And that person has to be elected with at least 7 votes. So you have to have both Democratic and Republican support. That, I mean, Steve is right that people, all of us, have certain built-in biases about things. But legislators, those people are, those of us who are fortunate enough to serve in the Virginia General Assembly, do not own the seats. We have no more right to those seats than anybody that we represent. And we, in my view, we have a built-in bias when we draw the lines.
You know, we got 2 Democrats and 1 Republican up here, but let's give him his due. I mean, really, for him to introduce that bill was really significant, because there are very few Republicans who will even talk about that. And the leadership pretty clearly said, no, this bill's not going anywhere, and therefore it didn't, even though it made a lot of sense because it changed the criteria and made the criteria more fair. I don't think that's going to change until the courts change or the people who sit in the seats in Richmond change. But, you know, hope springs eternal. We'll try it next year. Maybe something, lightning will strike, and we'll win.
Let me mention one thing where, and Cree's right, I understand the independent commission. The difference, I think, from my perspective, is the Constitution's pretty specific. It gives the legislatures the authority to do that and have that process. The founders decided they wanted an elected body to do that. Now, if we think, or the public thinks, that that needs to be removed from the elected body, I think we'll either the courts or the public will tell us that. As a legislator, I can tell you my job is to be a legislator, and that means to try to preserve and protect the prerogatives of the legislative branch. I'm not an attorney. I'm not in the judiciary. I've not run for governor, and at this point, after watching my friend Cree run for governor and some other friends, I don't think I ever want to do that. Nor do I think I have the resources, or probably that my wife would let me the time to do that. But and that's why, as a legislator, I try to be cognizant of those responsibilities. I don't look at that as a partisan thing. I just look at that as the responsibility of the separation of powers and the legislative branch.
As a point of information, let me just add that the Senate version of Steve Landis's redistricting criteria bill passed the Senate by a margin of 35-3. So we did make some progress. Next question. Industrial hemp. Why did this pass this year? What has changed? Does this say anything about marijuana law changes.
You know, I don't know whether it says anything about marijuana law changes, but, you know, I don't know if any of you all ever watched that RFD network. You know, there's the Kentucky Farm Bureau has an old this is probably a 10-year-old show where they're from an agricultural standpoint out there, they're using industrial hemp to make car bodies. There are lots of things we can do with industrial hemp. It just makes sense. Now the bottom line is, with respect to hemp, is we still have problems with the federal government because they list marijuana as a schedule one narcotic, a schedule one drug. So no matter what we do with hemp or with marijuana, we got to live with what the federal government's rules are, and we've got to know, just like Washington State and Colorado and Hawaii and other states, D.C. know that if the administration, that their ability to have legal marijuana is good as long as you've got a president who will not enforce the federal law. But if you have a new president, those laws in those states that legalize marijuana are going to go away, could go away. So industrial hemp makes sense. It can revitalize rural areas. It can revitalize the agricultural economy. It makes sense in lots of respects. But you really need change at the federal level before it can be that effective.
And I think for those of us that represent rural areas, and Cree and I have got a fairly, you know, parts of the districts we represent are fairly rural, it's another great potential agriculture product that can be grown in Virginia, and we hope that the research related to what Virginia Tech is doing will show that it might be a good alternative agriculture product, and then actually there's some export opportunities too, which would be great. But Cree's exactly right. Until the federal government finally decides that we're going to allow this, that is problematic. For medical marijuana uses, we've started down the road to allow, and I've supported for medical marijuana use, at least with the oils at this point, which is a first step. And I support and have talked to many people that they've moved into Virginia, and where the states have allowed this, it is one of the only things that they can use that will deal with the pain and the situation they're having from a medical standpoint. And many doctors have determined that it is, for certain patients, it is a viable alternative for medical treatment. So I think we need to continue to investigate. But again, that's tied up with what's going to happen at the federal government level.
But I think you are going to see a lot more interest in medical marijuana and the ability to use it for medical purposes in the next 5 to 10 years. Last year, we passed a really interesting bill that allowed the use of cannabis oil to be utilized to help with youngsters who and other people who had epilepsy. And it had really good effects on seizures. In fact, I talked to a constituent just the other day who has been able to avail themselves of that oil, and they're saying that the seizure levels have really dropped in number and severity. So it really does work. The problem is, for those people, they couldn't get it legally. Even though you could use it legally in Virginia, you couldn't get it legally. So this year we passed a bill that allows limited production in Virginia of those oils, and that'll make it easier for Virginia residents to have access to it.
It basically allows the State Board of Medicine, the State Board of Pharmacy, to develop regulations. I mean, I had people, farmers, call me in the past year that said, hey, can we start growing marijuana? Because we got this market. We can start growing and selling marijuana legally. Well, we didn't say that in legislation last year. We said you could use it legally, but you still had to travel to Colorado or D.C. and get the stuff. And bringing it back across state lines might not be legal either.
It isn't.
So there were still lots of problems with what we passed. What we have tried to do in that respect is give people some hope, because primarily we were talking about children who struggle with a severe epilepsy, and the only thing that gives them any relief from the seizures has been this cannabis oil.
Yeah.
The next questioner referred to the compromises that all speakers have referred to and asks whether there are lessons learned here that could create a path to permit Virginia to accept the federal funds that would provide health insurance for low-income adults. In other words, Medicaid expansion.
Well, I'm confident that in time we will we'll accept the dollars. You know, I think that a lot of people, some people hold out hope that a Republican will be elected president, then the Affordable Care Act will be undone, and then Medicaid expansion will not be an issue anymore. Well, I don't think that is going to happen. But let's assume that you've got a president elected who doesn't support the Affordable Care Act. 30 states now have adopted Medicaid expansion. 30 states now are taking and relying on those dollars. I don't think that we are going to be able to stop it at the federal level without a revolt. I think that, you know, some people say with the federal government, we're not sure the money will keep coming. Well, Medicaid has been the law since 1965, and the checks have always come, and we've always been able to cash them. So I think there are lessons, and certainly in the work we've done on education, the work we did with the guns this year was unbelievable. The NRA came to the table for the first time in my life, and we were able to work together as Democrats and Republicans to get things done that benefited people on both sides of that issue, I think. And I think we can do the same thing. The Medicaid expansion is unbelievably important. Number one, we're already paying the money. People that make more than $200,000 a year are paying the money. Over $1 billion a year goes from Virginia taxpayers to the federal government for Medicaid expansion. For us to get that money back, we've got to expand Medicaid and provide insurance, health care insurance, for up to 400,000 people, 75% of whom either work full-time, work at Walmart or wherever, that not enough, where they're not offered insurance and they don't make enough money to pay for insurance, or they live with somebody that does. And more importantly to me, somewhere between 62,000 and 77,000 of those people have severe mental illness. Over $200 million would go to provide coverage for those people. That would be a significant impact, health impact, for Virginia. So I'm hopeful that we can reach compromise on that eventually. I'm confident that we will.
Well, as Paul Harvey used to say, there's always the rest of the story. Although I think there is a way, and I think this year's session related to the compromises was a good example of, if people talk across party lines and try to come up with a mutual solution where you give a little bit here and you give a little bit there, I think you can always come to a resolution. Having been in the legislature 21 years now, I can tell you that's easier said than done sometimes, dealing with personalities. The problem is, if the personalities were all like the three of us here, we could probably get a lot more done. But we're not all, the General Assembly is not made up of all, you know, Creed Eads, Steve Landis's, or David Toscano. And it's also regional. You know, we all represent part of the same region. So obviously we talk and we know what people are telling us. And, you know, generally they tell you the same thing from the same region. But Southwest Virginia, Southside Virginia, Northern Virginia, Hampton Roads, they don't always say the same thing that we're hearing. So I think there is an opportunity. So that's one part of the question. The challenge is, from the federal government standpoint, is that, and from my standpoint, is I do worry about what the future of the nation is going to be from a financial standpoint. And I worry because I've got a 13-year-old son. So what is his life going to be? What is his family going to see in the future? And more importantly, I'm going to be one of those retirees that potentially is going to get Medicare and Social Security. And then Medicaid is the third part of the biggest part of the spending for the federal government. You know, they're $17, $18 trillion in debt. And even though they have paid to the recipients on a historic basis, if you talk to the pensioners and the people in Greece, that was the case for 50 or 60 years as well. And now they're not getting payments. And now that country is in trouble. Now, Greece is a lot smaller country than the United States, and we're still a superpower, one of the few superpowers. But when you look at things from a financial standpoint, you can't have more people receiving benefits that are than that are paying in to pay for those benefits. And that's what's really happening in our nation. And that's partly because my generation has had fewer kids than your generation and than my parents' generation did. Mathematically, it's very hard to make those systems work. So what's the solution to that? Well, the solution is either to cut benefits. And at the federal level, let's be honest, what president or member of Congress or U.S. senator is going to come back to you and say, we're going to cut your Social Security or your Medicaid or Medicare benefits? But that does leave Medicaid, because the states now pay, some states 50%, like we do in Virginia. Some states pay less, which is a whole other thing that the whole formula needs to really be looked at because of affordability that states could pay in 1965 when the system was set up. That's not fair to states like Virginia, who probably would be getting a little higher share if you were to relook at the formula on affordability for states. But if the federal government doesn't have the money, then the states are going to be responsible for that. And that's an if. And Cree's right. Historically, they have, they've made good on that payment. But if they do continue to make good on the payment, where's that money going to come from? Well, I can tell you where it's going to come from. You're going to have to increase the taxes for my son and Cree's children and David's son. Because that's how you're going to mathematically make it work out, unless you reduce the benefits. Now, at the federal level, they're going to have to work that out, because it is a federally driven system. Now, who do you think that, at least in this atmosphere, with the people that are either running for president of the United States on either side, or that are running for Congress, or that have run for U.S. Senate, are going to bite the bullet and make the hard choices that they're going to have to make to solve the problem? I'm not real confident that that's going to happen. So where does that leave the Commonwealth of Virginia? It leaves us to try to fix the problem. And I think there is a way for us to accept the Medicaid expansion money if the federal government were to allow us some flexibility. And that would be that we're not obligated long term if the money is not there any longer, given the scenario I just kind of set out with the players that we have that are in charge. And again, that's both parties. That's not just Republican or Democrat. That's getting them to work together and actually solve the problem realistically. And I think there'd be a way to do that through a block grant program. There's been some proposals to do that. And then Virginia could decide how we would set up a system so that individuals could be covered, but we do it in a way where if the money's not there, Virginia could either ratchet back those benefits or those services, or we figure out another way to make that cost effective. Now, having said all that, Medicaid is the fastest growing part of Virginia's budget. It's 22% of the Commonwealth's budget. 22%, single largest item, if you will, for spending, other than if you combined higher ed and public education. Those are the other area. That's the other area that's a large, significant part, about 40-45% of the budget. Everything else is everything else we spend state money on. So you can see from the state standpoint, there are not a lot of easy answers. Now, one of the things that we're going to try to do this year related to Medicaid is to look at additional reforms. We started that process. We want to continue that process and making sure we make our system as cost effective and as helpful to individuals from the standpoint of providing services. Because we all know that, and Creed's exactly right, if you get people the services and prevention and those types of things, it keeps the cost down and it's better for them individually as well. So we want to continue to look at for ways to do that. In fact, I just had a meeting Monday with Secretary Hazel, and they're, again, working across party lines. There are ways to do that and to be successful in doing that. And that's what we need to look for. Work on those things that we can try to succeed at. And then I'll just end by one thing. One of the other things is to look for other reforms in health care. One of the things that the governor's actually considering, and I was fortunate enough to have a meeting with some of his policy folks on Monday. We had a bill, legislation I introduced for direct primary care agreements. The medical community really wants those. And then what that would allow you to do is, if you want to get a certain level of service with your doctor, rather than have it paid for by insurance or go through the insurance company, if you or a small business wanted to provide this to their employees, you could do that with a contract. that wasn't insurance, and that you would agree and the doctor would agree, that's what the service is going to cost, and that's what I want to pay for. And it'll help people with high deductible plans, or again, folks that are with small businesses that may not be able to provide their employees with a, you know, robust health care plan, but want to provide this additional benefit. So that's the kind of thing that we need to also look at in reforming our health care system.
You can tell this is really complicated, intricate. A lot of it has to do with demographics, which is great for the country and a challenge to the country because we're all getting older, and as we get older, we utilize more and more health care. Long-term care is a huge part of the Medicaid issue, a huge part of the budget, and not easy to fix with reforms. Not easy. I think it is interesting to hear my colleagues talk about the ability to compromise on this issue, because I think a lot of people want to find a way to compromise to get those dollars back here. And I think sometimes if you can sort of step back from the politics, because this thing is being whipsawed by politics, unbelievably so. And if we do Medicaid expansion in Virginia, we're never going to call it that, not in a million years. It's not going to be called that at all. The irony, of course, is that we know that Medicaid is increasing a percentage of the Virginia budget. But at the same time, we see a need, and we go ahead and fill it. I mean, Steve and I have talked about this a lot. We go back and forth on the House floor about it all the time. You know, we expanded Medicaid this year. We just did it the most inefficient way possible, because the way it works now, the federal government's going to reimburse us dollar for dollar. It's 50%. Under Medicaid expansion, we could put up zero and get a dollar from the feds, but we're not doing it that way. So because there are populations that we feel it's important to try to help, people who have intellectual disabilities, they can get into this waiver program, but that's Medicaid. And every time we put another person in, that is another blank amount of money in the Virginia budget that we've got to get from the feds. I mean, if we accept the argument that we got to worry about whether the feds will ever pay us the money, why should we be putting these people on? That doesn't make any sense. So there's more to this issue about Medicaid expansion than just thinking about whether the feds will be able to come up with the cash long term. I think if we keep talking, maybe we can find a way. But we have to find a way soon, because there are some segments of our state who are going to feel the heat because they're not going to get as much money from the federal government to perform services. And I'm talking about hospitals. And they call it disproportionate share. The feds were going to cut that back as part of the ACA, and then they delayed the cutbacks. But they're coming. And when they hit, there are a lot of hospitals are really going to be feeling the pain, especially rural hospitals, smaller hospitals. We won't feel it as much here because we have a big teaching facility. We'll be able to kind of soak it up. Of course, you'll all pay every time your insurance goes up. But, you know, we service people. We're going to keep servicing. But you go to Southwest Virginia, where the hospitals are smaller and they run on much more smaller margins, they're going to have a harder time of it. And I think we have to realize that and try to figure out how we're going to solve it. And right now, we haven't gotten there. So hopefully, we'll just keep working and see if we can come up with some good solutions.
Can I add just one more thing to this very complex subject? And I know you all are about ready to go to sleep, but I 70% of the state Medicaid money is spent on long-term care. That's about 29% of the recipients of Medicaid. Now, Medicaid was never intended to be long-term care insurance. It was intended to be insurance for the desperately poor. Yep. It's growing so fast because we're getting so old. And we're getting so old, and we've not we it's a national failure. We failed to provide for long-term care. And that's the biggest reason why Medicaid is growing so fast.
He had a bill on that too.
We're living longer. That's the other thing. When it originally was set up, the life span for American was much fewer years. And so we're all living longer. And Creed's exactly right. And by living longer, obviously that long term care cost is grown exponentially.
Right. Next question. Virginia spends roughly as much on incarceration as on higher education. Aren't there ways to improve, quote, corrections, close quote, outcomes, and maybe reduce costs?
Well, Steve can probably talk at the money better than me on this. One thing I'm working on right now is a way, about 24% of the people that are incarcerated are mentally ill. And I'm looking at models from other states where they divert more of the mentally ill into treatment, particularly those who might be nonviolent offenders. I don't know if you all have read this recent, but last year there was a kid down in Portsmouth, 24 years old, schizophrenic, shoplifts $5 worth of junk food. They get him. They don't divert him. They take him into jail. They get him to the court. They see he's obviously got a problem, and they want him evaluated. He languishes in jail for 3 or 4 months, and then dies basically of starvation. Well, the family just filed a big $60 million lawsuit over it yesterday, and maybe they'll get some answers that way, because two state agencies have investigated, and neither one of those really got satisfactory answers about what happened. And that's a long way of saying we have to find alternatives for many people to go to jail. Certainly there are cheaper ways we can address their needs than through incarceration. I think primarily we have to look at the mentally ill, but also nonviolent offenders. We've got to look at ways, cost-efficient ways to serve them.
And I agree with Creed that the mental health piece is very concerning, because if you look at regional jails, even in the state institutions, penal institutions we have, or state correctional facilities, it costs about $30,000 to $40,000 a year to house a state responsible inmate. It costs about the same amount to put someone through college. So in Virginia, on average, so. It is a concern. It is a big expense. Actually, overall, our prison population has actually decreased. As violent crimes have gone down, we've seen a decrease. But the costs keep going up for a number of reasons. One is we have older inmates. Just as we were talking about, all of us are getting older. A lot of our inmates, long-term inmates, are getting older, and there are a lot of costs associated with their health care and the like, and the care. So even though the average may be $30,000 or $40,000 for an older inmate, in our facilities, it's probably two times that, or double. So we've got to do more. I'm glad Cree's joint subcommittee is looking at the mental health piece, but that's a tough one, because our mental health agencies will tell you that they don't have access or responsibility related to individuals that have mental illness that are in our especially regional jails, and to a certain extent, the state facilities. And we've got to do a better job of that. If we can divert them to a program, and we've tried to build additional dollars for crisis intervention for mental health, and we've really tried to make additional investments, and we need to do more of that, because if you can get to people early and you get the mental health services they need, then they don't need to go to a jail, or they won't be acting out where they are doing something like a petty crime or the like. But if someone's done a petty crime and has a mental illness, they shouldn't be going into a regional jail anyway. Somehow the system's just not working from that standpoint. So we've got to do a better job educating law enforcement individuals. If you talk to most law enforcement folks, they don't want to transport and take someone who they know is mentally ill and put them in a regional or local or state correctional facility. They know it's not going to be a good situation for them. So we need to work on that. The other thing that I think has some great benefit is home incarceration. There is a way now with technology to know where somebody is every hour of the day. And we don't need to put them in a regional jail or a local facility. But again, the judicial system, the law enforcement community has got to get up to speed. And we've got to look at what the costs are related to that technology. And technology, you know, even in Albemarle County, there's some discussion about pockets and areas that you can't get broadband. Well, that kind of technology's got to be able to work, and you got to have that kind of coverage to be able to make a home incarceration system work, so that if you're going to have someone at home. The other good thing about home incarceration is those individuals can go ahead and continue to work, be with their family, and make restitution as they're working for their debt to society, whatever that penalty is or whatever those court costs are or whatever they may owe for a nonviolent crime. Now, violent criminals, I think we need to let the judicial system work. And for those violent criminals, we do need to protect the public from those individuals if they've been found and convicted of serious crime like that, and protect the public. And that's what our facilities, both the regional and the state facilities, should be for. And if we can do all those things, it'll reduce the cost, and we'll actually have people that should be incarcerated, and the individuals that can be at home or be getting the treatment and services they need not in our facilities.
Well, I think these guys probably said almost everything that needs to be said, but yeah, we're going to want to put the real bad guys away. I mean, got to make sure that they're not danger to us. But there's so many people who don't need to go to jail who could be diverted. So I support drug courts. I support mental health courts. I support what they're called problem-solving courts, veterans courts, different ways that the judiciary, I mean, the entryway, somebody commits an offense. And the entryway is to the courts. If you've got judges who know what they're doing, you've got law enforcement who know what they're doing, if you've got a network of mental health professionals who know what they're doing, you don't need to put those people in jail. That saves a lot of money. The good news is that I think a coalition of more conservative legislators who look very closely at the bottom line and more liberal legislators who, for one reason or another, don't think so many people should be in jail, might be able to get together and come up with something that would work using some of the technology that Steve referenced. The challenge is going to be, though, that there are groups in the legislature who every time you turn around, they want to pass a new law that puts people in jail for longer periods of time and doesn't let them out. You know? And what you ought to do sometime is just track watch all those bills that get put in, and each one of those bills that creates a new offense or increases the penalty for an offense has a fiscal impact. And the legislature gets those fiscal impacts reported back to them. They're millions and millions of dollars. And you have to ask yourself, how prudent fiscally are people who continue to put those bills in, knowing that the fiscal impact of the state is going to be dramatic, where you could be reinvesting in mental health or doing some other things that might be more productive. Yeah, there are some things I think we can do. I think we are going to do that. You saw some movement on the juvenile justice side this year, because the juvenile incarcerated people numbers are falling as well. And there's a lot of sense that it's time to take these kids out of these big facilities and put them in smaller facilities. And we've got money in the budget, I think planning money in the budget, for a couple of these smaller facilities, which I think will be a lot better. I think we've got a better chance of getting these kids out so they can resume their participation in the community without committing future offenses, and it'll cost less money.
Next question. What ethics legislation was passed this session, and what more needs to be done?
You want to start?
Well, long and short of it, there wasn't much passed, actually. You know, there's a lot of discussion, but there wasn't much passed. And I think, you know, the challenge that all of us have is this stuff is so intricate, and you want to make sure that whatever you pass, you don't pass a law that makes it's a trap for the unwary. You know, a lot of us talk about the best solution to this problem is people to pay attention to what's proper and what's not. And it has nothing to do with the law. I mean, sometimes I get confused. I think that if Dominion offered me a trip to the Masters, I think I could go as long as I reported it. But even though it could be an educational trip, in the sense that I need work on my putting stroke, I don't think it'd be proper for me to go. So, you know, this is a lawyer saying this, the law be damned. You know, I'm looking at what's proper and what's not. Long and short is we didn't pass anything. And it'll be great because I've got to get going to do my law work in a second. So I have to listen to these guys say what they thought was passed, and then I have to leave.
Well, I think David's right. We didn't do anything significantly. We tried to make some adjustments, and I will tell you that the House, interestingly enough, tends to be willing to make more stringent requirements. And I don't know where Cree's on this, but the Senate overall, at least the Senate leadership, is not too enamored with having additional requirements. And I think David's right. Some of these things are just common sense. For instance, I don't think any of us have ever reported a trip to the Masters because we probably thought, you know, that probably just not appropriate. Why would Dominion want to take me to the Masters? I actually had, I'll give you an example that I just told them I wasn't going to do. I was invited by, I think, Virginia Uranium to go on a trip to Canada and France to look at nuclear power plants.
I was invited too.
Yep. And I said, you know, since we're considering that legislation, I just don't think that's appropriate.
I didn't go either.
And I also said, you know, I've actually been to a nuclear power plant. It's called North Anna. And it's in Virginia, and I know how those work, and I know how uranium is used in as a fuel for, you know, that power plant. So I kind of know how that works. But a lot of it's just common sense. But I agree with the $100 limit that we've got. I think that makes sense. That if you can't use your common sense, that at least gives you a barometer to hopefully you're using. Now, we'll tell you, we're having some problems even within the advisory council now, what's appropriate and not. And generally, my rule of thumb is if it's over $100, I just don't do it. And if it's more than $50, I'm not really enamored, you know, with it, whether it's a book or whatever. But if it's something we've gotten from a constituent or something like that, I just report it, or a group. But I don't take a lot of those things and don't have not had to report a lot of things, obviously, because of that. I will tell you that even before the requirement that we had, I was reporting things that people didn't report. For instance, a lot of my colleagues, and they're doing it now, you know, we get invited to go to football games at UVA. So, you know, if my son and I came to a football game, I would report that. I would find out from the university what the cost was and report that. Now, most of my constituents don't care whether I go to UVA football games or not, as long as, you know, they can go and whatever. But that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that you just have to determine as an individual. But I think we've made some great strides. I think we probably can do more. But as David said, it's got to make sure that it's common sense and it's fairly easy, because if you make it too complicated, it's going to have an unintended consequence of somebody doing something they didn't intend to do and they've broken the law. And a lot of folks are not attorneys in the legislature, and they may not know, you know, the ins and outs. But this advisory council is supposed to help those of us that are non-attorneys be able to make a request and say, is this appropriate or not? And then at least we're getting some advice. And I think that's a good thing.
You know, one of the problems in the Senate is a lot of the leadership has taken hunting trips, different groups, or they've gone to Turkey, or they've gone to Korea, or they've gone to Japan. And general, the rule that I follow, and I've not always met the test, but what I'm going to do or say, or in the legislature, is something I wanted to be able to tell my children about at night when I tucked them in. And so I've tried, and if you have to think about it, don't do it, you know. If you have to think about it, don't do it. We've passed bills the last couple of years that have kind of moved the shell around a little bit in terms of amount of gift and things like that. I think what people are most worried about, concerned about, is money in politics. You know, in Virginia, for example, right now, you can take as much money as you want, as much money as you can get from whomever you can get it from. In Virginia right now, a legislator can go to his campaign account and treat it like an ATM
as long as he can say, well, it's campaign related. Well, I filled up my gas tank this morning with my campaign credit card. You know, I don't think that's appropriate. And if you're not, you know, as a legislator, you know, we're part-time citizen legislators. It's not how you're supposed to earn all your living. It's not how you're supposed to live, you know, as a legislator off your account. I think you could tighten up the money regulations. I think you could tighten up the use of the campaign account. There are significant things you can do, but I don't know that we'll be able to do those things. You will pass more bills that'll move the shells around a little bit, but that's about all.
David, I know you have to leave. Before you go, you advertised at the beginning the good, the bad, and the funny. It lived up to its billing.
Yeah, it was good.
Another question. Virginia has set up a radon mitigation standards, but the agency doesn't have any enforcement or investigation powers. Why is this the case?
Radon. Well, I can tell you that I'm not intimately familiar with the legislation, but lots of times bills get passed that sound all nice and shiny, but they're not enforceable, and there's no real mechanism in place. And if that's what this bill says, or that's what this legislation says, it's not the only place in the code that you've got ineffective legislation, ineffective words.
I would agree with Cree. I don't know, and not as familiar with the legislation as maybe I should be. Generally, my rule of thumb is I don't actually vote for something unless we're going to make sure that there's some mechanism for enforcement. It's almost a hollow law. Or if we're not going to provide the funding to make sure we can implement it. We do a very bad job sometimes of setting up, for instance, I'll give you one example, very laudable purpose, and that is to set up a fund for the rising sea levels in the eastern part of the state and to have a fund that businesses or individuals can apply to. Guess what? Guess how much we appropriated for this new fund? Zero. So I didn't vote for it. Not because I didn't think it was a good idea. I said, as a member of the Appropriations Committee, if we're going to do it, let's at least put some money in there. And if we're not, then let's not have the fund set up. So.
And one last question. What, if any, strides were made this session on mental health reform?
Well, the majority, the way the mental health study was set up was we were going to make an interim report this past December, and we did. The legislation that we went forward with was pretty small. What we were trying to do primarily was incentivize people to go into mental health fields. A problem we've got in Virginia, and it's a problem nationally, is we have a real lack of mental health professionals. Give you an example, two examples. In the Suffolk CSB, which is Western Tidewater CSB, it's Chris Jones' home community, there was one child psychiatrist who was doing 100% of the work for that CSB. She moved to Florida. She's still doing 95% of the work through telepsychiatry because there's nobody else there. There are 10 childhood psychiatrists in Lynchburg. There aren't 10 in Virginia west of Lynchburg. We have a real problem with, and what we tried to do, and I carried the bill, Delegate Yost carried the bill in the House, what we tried to do was create a fund of money to provide loan forgiveness for people that would agree to go into mental health profession and go into a medically underserved area and stay there for 5 years. Now, we weren't successful. But so the strides we made this year and big stuff wasn't, you know, it wasn't anything to write home about. But we are aiming toward 2018, and we've got a pretty ambitious agenda with respect to 2018. We're broken up now into four work groups, one that will focus on structure and financing of our mental health system. Emmett Hanger, Senator from Augusta, is chairing that. Second one that's focused on something we've already talked about some, the intersection of criminal justice and mental health. Rob Bell from Albemarle is chairing that. A third one that's looking at crisis intervention, what happens when a crisis occurs. We've got a subcommittee on that
Scott Garrett, delegate from Lynchburg, is chairing that. And the fourth work group that's focused on housing, Janet Howe is a senator from Fairfax that's focused on, is chair of that. But as important as all those people are, we've also brought into the loop for these last 18 months of our work, Richard Bonney from the University of Virginia. So we have some heavyweight people at the table now who can help guide our work. And so while we didn't make great strides this year, I'm hopeful that in 2017 to some degree, and certainly by 2018, my goal from the beginning has been to develop a system of mental health care in Virginia that's a model for the rest of the country. It gives me a great deal of pride to be able to tell those sixth grade students when I tell them, think about this. Democracy, our democratic republic, our experiment in democracy in this country started in Virginia in 1619, and to one degree or another, what happens in 49 other states and at the federal level is modeled after what happened here first, and still best in Virginia. We can do the same thing. We can say the same thing about mental health eventually. That's my hope. That's my goal, and I think by 2018 we will have built the case and have the support to get something important done.
In addition to all the work that CREA is doing and those recommendations, we have tried to provide additional funding for crisis intervention because we know there's been a real lack. The problem we have in Virginia, and CREA and I were talking about this earlier, is we have community services boards. Some of them are very good. They do a very good job, a very excellent job in their local communities. Others do not. And so we've got to look at that system and how to really work and integrate all the recommendations that the CREA's Joint Subcommittee is looking at, but build that system so that it is community-based and that services are community-based. Because that's the best way to try to prevent and to also reach out and to catch folks, if you will, that need the services. Now, having said that, we're struggling with our big institutions that we have. And there's still going to be a need for mental health, behavioral health hospitals in Virginia, both geriatric care and then for temporary stays for other mental health needs. The challenge we're having is what is going to be the right size and how many of those are we going to have and where they're going to be. And if we can right size that system, it will free up resources that we can reinvest into the community services in conjunction with what CREA is working on. So I'm hoping what will happen is as CREA's joint subcommittee comes forward with the recommendations and with the budget requests, we'll have done the work and looking at what size our state facilities should be and making sure that then the additional resources we have can partially be put to and make the investment for those community-based services that they're working on and trying to solve those issues. So hopefully that'll work in tandem.
And there are really some important points in what Steve said. We have 40 CSBs or their equivalent. Under the Code of Virginia, they can be organized three separate ways. So you have 39 CSBs and one behavioral health authority. They all get funded by the state, but they get funded by local governments too. And some of the local governments do a real good job of funding them. Some do not do a good job. And so you have a very disparate system. We have to get to the point where no matter where you live in Virginia, you can get quality services. And so that's what we're working on.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.